And tonight we're talking about extreme fear. Our special guest, Jeff Wise. More to come with Jeff in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff Wise, what do you think the percent is people who lose control when they're scared, when there's fear?
Well, I don't think you can really put a percentage on it because it depends on the situation. And, somebody who can do very well, you know, standing in front of a huge crowd might crumble if, you know, an armed gunman, you know, mugs them or something. And we all have, I mean, there are situations in which any one of us will panic and lose it. We, you cannot just override by force of will that automatic X system when it's fully engaged.
Do you find, though, that some people can thrive with fear?
Well,
react better.
You know, the flip side of panic is you know, handling fear in a positive way, and that's something I've looked at quite a bit. You know, what is the secret to resilience? What is the secret to taking a difficult experience and turning it into something positive? And a lot of it is just how some people are just better, have trained themselves or are naturally more inclined to look at a bad, something on its surface just seems like a bad thing, a bad happening in their life, and look at it as a challenge, as an opportunity to grow. I just did a piece for Men's Health about making mistakes, and one of the lessons is that a mistake, an error, a screw-up can be really a way to learn and a way to grow. So I think that's that's really the missing factor.
I mean, there's nothing like learning from your mistakes. I mean, that's, I think, the best way to learn.
Well, when I asked readers on my website, if they wanted to share some of their own mistakes that they made that were memorable to them, and some people wrote in with some really interesting things. And one woman wrote about how she'd been in a situation where she had said, you know, inadvertently kind of the wrong thing. And you know, we've all done that, where you see an old friend you haven't seen in a while, and oh my gosh, congratulations, I didn't know you were pregnant. Oh, well, I'm actually not pregnant, I just put on some weight. Oh, oops, you know, you can't take it back. And you just feel that hot, hot feeling of regret.
That's one of the worst things to say, too, isn't it?
And there's so many ways we can do that. But there's a reason why we find those moments so difficult to eradicate from our memories. And we would love to forget that ever happened, but we just can't. And there's a reason for that, because all of these seemingly negative emotions that we have that seem just like bad things, and we wish we could never feel fear, we wish we could never feel guilt or shame, but they all exist for a reason. They exist to keep us out of trouble. And once you've said to a pregnant woman, to a non-pregnant woman, to congratulate her on her pregnancy, you never do it again. You will never do that again. Because the moment that thought starts to burble out from your subconscious,
you catch yourself.
That emotional memory kicks in, and that automatic part of your brain goes, nah, stop. Don't do it. Remember what happened last time.
So when you wrote Extreme Fear, The Science of Your Mind in Danger, what was probably the most compelling aspect of that work for you?
Well, it turns out to be one of these topics that the more you go into it, the more incredible it turns out to be, and the more you realize the strange ways and the counterintuitive ways that the automatic brain works, the more you find yourself watching yourself and saying, "Oh, that's really interesting." And as it happened, as I was writing the book, I got the contract to write the book when we just found out my wife was pregnant. And so I'm working on the book, and I've gotten up to the chapter that talks with how we handle fear when we're in the moment. I mean, one of the lessons of the book is, you know, if you really want to handle fear well, you're best off to prepare beforehand. If you know the situation in which you're likely to face danger or difficulty or stress, prepare beforehand, because as I said, the fear will shut down your conscious brain. But then I was working on a chapter about, okay, so I've done all the preparation or lack of preparation or whatever. Now I'm in it. What can I do now that I'm in it? And my wife decided that she wanted to have a home birth. And so we had a sort of a celebrity midwife.
That's pretty, that's kind of bold, isn't it?
I mean, listen, some of my friends and family tried to do an intervention to say, don't do this, it's crazy.
In
But,
case, yeah.
we thought this is going to be an interesting
Why'd
experience
you
for
want to
us,
do
et
that?
cetera. And so long and short, it turns out to be really difficult. I mean, it was not one of these glowing, oh, here, my baby just popped out, and look how beautiful it is. It was like 72 hours of grueling
Labor.
torture.
Oh.
And my wife, by the end of it, had to go to get a C-section.
She had to go to the
and,
hospital anyway, then, right?
Huh?
Did they do the C-section at home?
No, no, no.
Oh,
no.
No.
No,
Okay.
no, that would have been that would really be
that
the
would have been a disaster.
No, so we go to the hospital and whatever the usual thing happens. The baby's fine, healthy, and cute, and everything. But at the time, I remember the midwife was this super crunchy lady, who was her essential attitude was, if you don't have your baby at home naturally, you fail. And so she really wanted us to not fail. And my attitude was, I want my wife to be healthy. I want my baby to be healthy. And so it's the middle of the night. It's like, I don't even know where the midwife is. She's gone off to help somebody else. And I realized to myself, wow, this is really for all the marbles. And all this stuff that I've been writing about is kind of an intellectual exercise. It's real. I haven't really learned any tricks to be able to tell myself, okay, this is the right thing to do. It's really hard to make decisions under pressure.
Were you scared?
I was scared.
Yeah.
I was scared. And one of the things that happens when you're scared, one of the many things that happens in your brain when you're scared is you tend to defer to authority. And this is something that a lot of governments use to their advantage. But it's natural, like if everything is hanging in the balance, if your unborn baby's life is hanging in the balance and someone says to you, I know what's best, trust me, you will trust them. Because all you want to do is for everything to be okay. And I had to fight that. And I had been writing about it. And I intellectually, on an intellectual level, recognized that this effect takes place. But when I was in the middle of the night, there's something really daunting about doing anything in the middle of the night, to say, you know what, midwife, no. This is enough. we're going. And
off you go.
And off we go. And it was, and when I finally put my foot down, she was like, okay, that's what you want. That's what we're going to do. And she was fine. And we all went. And as I said, it was not easy from there even, but the baby wound up fine. But that was the kind of thing that it just happened time and again, when I was working on the book, that I would find, first of all, you don't really remember how many different kinds of fear that there are. Because I was working on another chapter not too long before this, where my wife, my sister's little girl, she fell and she knocked her head, and she wound up getting one of these things called a subdural hematoma, and it's a very scary thing. And it's one of these things where if you know what to do, it's actually not that dangerous. But if you don't do the right thing, meaning go in and have brain surgery, and this is what killed Natasha Richardson. And Natasha Richardson died like a week before this happened to my sister's kid. And if it hadn't happened to Natasha Richardson, I don't think it would have been as front of mind for us, and we wouldn't have known what to do. So I think Natasha Richardson might have saved, inadvertently, obviously.
Let me ask you about a soldier, Jeff.
Okay.
The fear of a soldier. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're brave. They face death every day,
right,
whether it's a sniper or a bombing or anything. Yet they perform. And, and I'm sure they're scared deep down inside.
Right.
But they perform. So here's an example of someone who is fearful.
Right.
But they perform, and you wouldn't even know. How come some people can do it, other people can't?
That's a great example of the idea that the best thing to do to deal with intense fear is to prepare. Because what the first thing that a military always does and has done since the beginning of time is do train, so that if you hear a certain sound, then do this, duck. Or in the olden days, they used to march and they would say, okay, present arms, and they would there was a certain sequence of actions that you would do,
right?
And that would and they would train. So it's called overlearning, and it gets to the point where it becomes so automatic that it is not suppressed by fear. So, as I said, the C system, this conscious part of your brain, is crushed by fear. But the automatic part of your brain is much more resilient. It's much more robust. And so you can get people to a point where, without even thinking, they do what they need to do. And I tell a story in the book about a guy who's a friend of mine, who's a special forces guy. And he was in Somalia back when. And he, out of the corner of his eye, he saw a guy running at him with a hatchet. And before he even consciously knew what he was doing, he had his pistol out and he shot the guy. Because it had been so trained
to do it. It's like driving a car.
Well, exactly. That's right. And if you do it 1,000 times, you do it automatically. And one thing is, you know, we walk around in the world and we feel like we're in charge of our actions. We feel like there's a little man in our head who's at the controls like a steam shovel. And that's not really how it works. That little man that we perceive being inside of our heads is only. Well, let me put it this way. It takes half a second before you even become consciously aware of what's happening around you. And so if you're when a batter is going to hit a ball coming over the plate, it takes less than half a second for the ball to go from the pitcher to the mound. And so he's hitting it or making the decision whether to hit it or not before he's consciously aware of it. Now, it feels to the batter like I'm consciously deciding to choose this pitch. Okay, I'm going to hit it, and he hits it. And it feels like a conscious action, but that is somewhat of an illusion. You're only even becoming aware of that sequence of events after it's already underway.
Yeah. I mean, the ball's not even there yet, and he's already reacting to it.
Yeah, and it's funny. I was riding on the subway, and I live in New York City, and I was engrossed in this article, and the doors, ping, they open, and then they ping, and they shut. And I found myself all of a sudden standing on the platform, and I realized that somehow some part of my brain had realized I might stop, and the doors are shutting, and I had jumped out, and I was on the platform. And, you know, we find ourselves doing this all the time, but because the mind creates powerful illusions for itself, and one of the most powerful illusions is intentionality, meaning we have this illusion of conscious action. And so we do often, you know, we do decide, you know, if you sit around and talk, okay, you know what, I'm going to go on vacation in Florida this year. That's a conscious intention that you form and then you carry out. But if you're walking down the street and all of a sudden you find yourself in the air and you realize it's because your neighbor's dog just jumped at you, you know, from behind a chain link fence, that is something that happens at a deep level of your brain that is beyond, you know, far removed from your conscious intention.
Jeff, some people, let's use me for an example. I don't scare easily, but let's say I open up the door and there's some face looking right at me. I kind of like jump back, right?
Yeah, sure.
What causes that?
Well, again, it's like you have your brain is wired to react to danger. And, you know, when we when our ancestors were living in a world that was full of, you know, wild animals and people throwing spears at us and so forth, you know, there's kinds of danger that you can only react to. That you have to react to quickly. And so we actually have multiple layers of defense built in. And some of them are very quick and very stupid. And so if you hear a loud, if someone likes a firecracker right behind your head, bang, it goes off, and within milliseconds.
You're jumping.
There's circuitry that's like incredibly simple. But then there's, you know, and that's the most primitive.
Is that a protective mechanism in our system?
It's protective. It's very dumb. It's protective. It's basically, okay, you've got no moment. You've got no time to prepare yourself to what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. It's a very generic kind of response that has evolved over, you know, hundreds of millions of years, essentially. So that basically what it does is it tells your brain, it's like a program that runs. It's like a computer program. And it says, if something really bad is about to happen to me super, super imminently, like within milliseconds, and you can do only one simple thing, it's like I'm going to sort of crouch. I'm going to like bend forward. I'm going to like raise my arms to sort of shield my chest area. And like this is sort of your generic defense. It's like maybe it's a tiger, maybe you know, it's a landslide. You know, this is sort of like your generic, you know, if you've got one response for all situations, that's what it's going to be, kind of like huddle. But then as time goes, you know, if you look at longer time scales, like 100 milliseconds, half a second, you get into more sophisticated kinds of, you know, you might orient towards the threat, meaning turn towards it. you might be able to engage in well-earned activity, you know. And so the more complicated parts of the brain are able to manage a more sophisticated response. And at the very longest time scale, you know, days, weeks, months, you know, you have the conscious part of your brain sits there and thinking, boy, I wonder what I'm going to do about my boss. You know, he's really getting on my nerves. And so we have a whole spectrum of defensive responses that we kind of lump together under the rubric of fear.
Are people more fearful now than they were years ago? Do we even have data like that?
Well, you know, I guess, no, we don't. I mean, and a lot of the more interesting research you know, is only happening in the last 10 years or so. So they haven't really been able to look back at data that's been collected a long time ago. But, you know, if you look back way back, you know, if you look at the bones of cavemen, they only got to be about 35 or 40 years old. And so, and, you know, you find skulls of our ancestors with holes in the skulls that are the same distance apart as the canines of panthers, you know. So, you know, people are being predated on by large animals and, you know, living hard, short lives. So I'm usually a little skeptical when people say life is more difficult now than it's ever been. I mean, at least we don't get eaten by lions, you know, so we got that going for us.
Right.
But, you know, people tend to adjust. People are very adaptable organisms. And if, you know, there have been studies, for instance, that I'm sure you've heard about this, that, you know, people who lose a limb in the long term wind up happier than people who win the lottery. Because people who win the lottery, you know, they find themselves in a very different kind of social economic situation. And they often become unhinged, and whereas people who lose a limb, you know, they can rally and become resilient and have a new appreciation for life. So, I guess, you know, it's really hard to say what constitutes fear. There's so many different kinds of fear.
What do you mean by mind traps?
Yeah, so I just did an article for Psychology Today. I'm very interested in the ways that we go wrong, and like we were talking earlier in the show about failure modes, meaning there's ways that machines break. And if you're a technician who deals with, you know, copying machines, you'll know, okay, oh, look, you know, it's the toner's out or the paper got jammed or whatever. And with people, I'm always fascinated that there seems to be ways that people again and again and again come to grief. And so I did an article for Psychology Today looking at some of the ways that people get into a trap. It's like a mental cul-de-sac that winds up causing disaster. And it can be, you can take an innocent step that leads to another step that leads to another step, and the next thing you know, you're sliding down towards disaster. And an example of this kind of thing is imagine that you're, there's a rule in hot air ballooning, which I stumbled upon. I was doing a story about hot air ballooning at one point. And one of the guys on the ground crew told me that there's a rule that you always have to have at least 1 foot on the ground at all times in a hot air, and when you're a ground crew for a hot air balloon. And I said, why? He said, because the minute you lose contact with the ground, maybe you're just an inch off the ground, and you think, well, that's no big deal. But now you're a foot off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You think, oh, you know what? I'm just going to wait till it comes down. I'm going to step down. Okay, now you're 5 feet up, and you think, well, you know, if I go now, I'm going to twist an ankle. And then you're 10 feet up, and you might, you know, break a leg. And now you're 20 feet up, and you're like, well, I could die. And next thing you know, you're 100 feet up, and you're still going up. And this sequence of events can happen very quickly.
Let's find out a little bit more about that, Jeff, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Jeff Wise as we talk about extreme fear. And I'd also like you to share some of your stories if you've gone through fear and how you pulled out of it. We'll be back. Jeff Wise with us. Jeff, let's go back to your analogy of your hot air balloon.
Right.
And so tell me, why do they have to keep a foot on the ground?
Right. So If you even leave the ground your foot off the ground and you feel, okay, I'm just going to wait till the balloon comes back down. When the higher you get, the worse the penalty you're going to have to pay for hanging on. And we have a quirk of our psychology called loss aversion, meaning we'd rather gamble double down. Throw the dice again and hope that everything's going to be okay. We'd rather do that and then consider the consequences of what if we don't, and we just take the loss. And so we get into a situation, it happens in finance as well, where people say, okay, rather than take the loss, I'm going to double down and see if I can regain what I lost. And what happens in the case of hot air balloons is you find yourself hundreds of feet up, and now you've got no options at all. And to me, it was a great example of how a very small, simple, automatic response can put you through a chain of events into a terrible situation that you can't escape from.
Well, that's true too. Are there advantages to being scared?
Yeah, I mean, the fear response evolved to help us, to keep us from danger. And even though it's a very unpleasant experience, a very unpleasant emotion, it enables us to survive situations that we otherwise wouldn't. It focuses our energy. It focuses our attention. It does a lot of really interesting things. For instance, it makes us impervious to pain. When you're in a really amped up state of mind, you don't feel that cut or that bruise. You just do what needs to be done. It also has a really weird effect that I've written about, and people can read about it on my website. I asked readers to write in and share their experience of this strange phenomenon called time dilation. It's as if time seems to slow down. And I think we're all familiar with that scene from The Matrix where Keanu Reeves is like, the bad guys are shooting bullets at him, and he's so super intelligent that he can like see the bullets coming at him. And that's an extreme example of something that really exists. And we can't really see bullets flying through the air, but people who are in car accidents often speak of being able to see every raindrop on the hood of their car or every digit of the license plate of the car that's heading towards them.
Well, superstar sports folks can slow things down. I remember Mickey Mantle saying that it looked like the ball was floating at him, or some hockey players, the great Gordie Howe, when a puck was passed to him before he slap-shotted it into the net, it would come to him really slow when it was really going very fast. They have that ability to slow down time.
Right, right. And so I like to say that fear, in essence, gives us superpowers because we're able to unleash our strength, our speed, our perception to a degree that's impossible otherwise. And so there's something, as unpleasant as fear is, there's something very attractive about it. And, we have the phenomenon of adrenaline junkies, people who go to this place that most of us shy away from, because they want that jolt, they want that sense of intensity. I start the book with a story of a famous British stunt pilot who was going through an aerobatic routine, and he's very low, going very fast, and one of his wings started to fall off. And it's the kind of thing where I know that if I was in that situation, I would have just panicked, and that phenomenon we talked about earlier where the fear just shuts down your conscious brain. I know I would have been overwhelmed and I would have just sat there dumbly as I crashed.
Yeah. Yet some people, it accents it.
Well, what he was able to do, and this was really the great riddle for me that I wanted to address in the book, how is it that some people can rise to the occasion and in that moment of intense danger where he was seconds away from losing his life, was able to not only not lose his mind, but actually to come up with a creative solution, that to really dig deep and to find that kind of creativity that usually is the first thing to go.
Right. And instantly. He didn't have time.
Yeah, exactly. And to get back to your superstar athlete analogy, because he was essentially a superstar athlete of flying, because he had learned the systems and the behavior of the aircraft so well, he knew it so deeply intuitively, he was able to his X system essentially had become an expert. So in an instant, and you see this kind of thing with chess masters, they're able to just look at a board in an instant and say exactly what's going to happen.
Bobby Fischer was one of the best.
Exactly. He could look at a board and say, you know, if he could look at a game between two other people that he hadn't been paying any attention to, and he could say white to checkmate in two moves.
Yeah.
And
anticipate
it's
their
that
moves.
Kind of deep, deep expertise that this pilot was able to call upon.
What you made reference to this Italian ship that went aground and all those people died.
Right.
You talked
right.
about the captain of the ship. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I was researching the way that people make mistakes, and here's a great example. You've got this perfectly functioning cruise ship that costs, you know, millions, hundreds of millions or billions or whatever.
Should float forever.
Should float forever. It should, you know,
no.
The last thing you would expect is that, you know, in an age of GPS and global coordinates and computerized everything, that you're going to run this thing into a rock.
And so sink?
Yeah, I mean, it's inconceivable, and it was just not only human error. I mean, it was pure human error, but it was human error of such a boneheaded kind.
Yes.
That kind of boggles the imagination. And so the question for someone like me is, what interesting, what does this tell us about the human brain that it's capable of this kind of terrible thing? You know, you've got these machines that are that can monitor the environment at a microsecond level. And here we are, these, you know, we've got these, you know, couple pounds of slushy gray matter in our skulls. We're so clever at building these fantastic machines, and we're so dumb at just driving them into the ground. We're really fascinating creatures in that regard. So smart and so dumb at the same time. And, you know, I don't know, the facts are still emerging in this case, but I don't know why this guy got this job. He obviously wasn't the greatest captain of all time.
He was not the pick of the litter, that's for
sure. I don't think so. I wouldn't hire him, although you could probably get him cheap now.
Would you take a cruise if you knew he was the captain?
Sorry?
Would you take a cruise on his ship if you knew he was the captain?
I don't think I would get on a boat if he was the deck swabber. I don't think there's any danger of that in the near future. But so even though, you know, the facts are still emerging, but I think there's some obvious things to take from that. One is to talk about mind traps, get back to the idea of there's certain areas in which we should really be on guard, because these are areas in which our inherent capacity to make mistakes really comes to the fore. And one of them is showing off. You know, there's a kind of an old saying that most common final last words of pilots is, look at this. You know, you're trying to impress somebody, you know, you become insane. I mean, you take risks that you would never take, you know, flying on your own or captaining a boat on your own, you know, without, you know, people standing on the shoreline of this Italian island, getting ready to wave hello to their loved ones on board. And so this guy goes way out from his, you know, prescribed route, and then he's on the rocks. And, you know, you look at you can see these images on the internet of this satellite pictures of this giant boat. It was, at the time it was built, it was the largest boat ever built in Italy. I mean, it's bigger than the Titanic. And there it is. It's right on the shore. You know, and I'm not a sea captain. I can't, you know, profess any expertise, but I do know that you're not supposed to put these things up on the rocks like that.
No, that's a no-no.
I think so. Keep it in the wet part of
the
ocean.
That's right. Well,
but you know, there's
he'll
other
pay
things.
The price for it.
Well, he paid the price. Well, and this is, I mean, he didn't stop there. That's the really interesting thing about this case, is that, you know, once this thing was on the rocks, he panicked. And, you know, the thing you're supposed to do when you're captain is to stay on board and make sure that everyone else gets off, just be the last one off the boat. And he, according to his account, he was going out and about and helping people, and he valiantly, you know, donating his life jacket to other people. And the boat was at an angle, and he rolled, and he fell into the lifeboat. And then the lifeboat departed and left, and like, there was really, you know.
How convenient.
I mean, so, you know, I think it raised a few eyebrows, this account. But it goes to show that, you know, when you're in a panic situation, and this guy didn't do the heroic thing. We'd all like to believe of ourselves that if we were that guy, we would do the right thing and we would stay and we would heroically assist the other passengers and so forth. We would all like to believe this of ourselves. And I would like to believe that if I was the pilot of Air France 447, that I would not pull the stick back until the plane hits the water. But one of the lessons of fear is that you don't know until you've been in that situation, until you've had that training and you've been exposed to that fear that you've never experienced before. You're in an unfamiliar situation. It's very easy for me to smugly sit in my chair and say, well, I know what the correct thing to do is, and I'm quite confident that I would have done it. But that's, you know, fallacious. I don't know what I would have done. And you have to have a respect for the uncertainties of the situation. You have to have respect for the vagaries of your own mind. And I get a lot of letters and emails and stuff from readers saying, you don't understand the situation. I've been in danger before. I've always done the right thing. I would never do this. And it's weird how defensive people get at the suggestion that they might not do the right thing in danger, because we're all the heroes of our own inner movie.
And you know what? People really don't know what they will do when confronted with some kind of fear or danger.
No. And you have to have respect for that. I think you have to be realistic. I mean, and this is one of the things I try to get across is the idea that there's an unfamiliar part of you. You have a stranger living in your skull with you, essentially. And it doesn't always behave the way you would like it to behave. And you shouldn't assume. Earlier I was talking about the experience that I think a lot of people have had where they're asked to get up and give a little speech. And it's astonishing how uncomfortable and almost impossible that can be.
Some people don't have the experience in front of a crowd. They're petrified.
No, nobody. I mean, to start with, nobody does. I mean, do you remember the first time you had to, you know, now it's a very comfortable.
See, I was trained early, Jeff. I'm different. You know, when I was a kid, and I'm talking six or seven, you know, my parents always encouraged me to do these little vaudeville things in front of our family. And I'm talking about a family of 40 or 50 people, cousins, uncles. And so at a very young age, man, I was trotted out on stage, basically. And so I got used to it early. You talk about training, I was trained early.
Right, right, right. I mean, it's like when you learn a second language at that age, it's effortless. And I guess probably the same thing for you.
Yes.
And the thing about there's a fine line between fear and thrill, and it's great if you can tap that. I think it's a way to help you overcome fear and to turn. You know, I was mentioning earlier about a lot of the secret of dealing with stress and fear and anxiety in life is getting in the mental habit of framing it in a positive way. And it might just be to say, okay, I know that I'm going to feel anxious when I get in front of this group of people. I know I'm going to stammer and stutter and feel embarrassed. But that at the end of it, I'm going to feel great. It's going to be over. And it's fascinating to me that people can react to the same exact thing in two really different ways. Daniel Kahneman, the esteemed legendary economist and psychologist, did an experiment a few years back where he said to people, I want you to choose your favorite ice cream and your favorite song. And then he had them eat that ice cream, a pint of that ice cream, while listening to their favorite song for, I think it was 10 days. And at the end of it, he said, are you going to like that ice cream and are you going to like that song?
They were sick of it, right?
People amazingly were very bad at predicting about themselves whether they were going to get to the end of that 10 days and like that ice cream or hate that ice cream. And I'm the kind of guy who, like, I eat the same thing for breakfast every day. And I like it.
A creature of habit.
I used to date a girl whose father was in the Bataan Death March in the Philippines during World War II. And he wound up in a prison, Japanese prison camp for 4 years. And according to the story, all he got to eat every day was an onion. They would give him an onion.
An onion?
And that was what he ate.
A raw onion.
And for the rest of his life, He loved onions. You know, I think a lot of people after that situation would just not ever want to see another onion in their life.
I know a guy who works in a pizza place and he hates pizzas.
Yeah.
He's fed up with them. He's sick of them.
Well, that's pretty easy to understand, but there's probably pizza people who work in pizza places and that's all they eat is pizza. I mean, it's weird.
One of them until he got tired of it.
Right. But it just goes to show that it's very difficult. You know, it's very hard to make a blanket statement about, you know, fear will do this to our brain or we will respond to fear in this way. Given some kind of fearful situation, some people will take to it like fish to water. Some people will become horrified at it. So the only thing we can really do, and this is kind of a true of life in general, is if you can learn to watch yourself, you can learn to observe your own reactions to things, and then that can tell you which direction to move. You know, can you look on the bright side? Can you think, wow, this is an experience that's really going to enhance my life? It's going to empower me. I mean, we tend to be so instinctively aversive to fear. We tend to avoid scary situations, and why not? It's unpleasant. There's a big overlap in the machinery of fear and the machinery of being sick. When you are in a chronically anxiety-producing situation, your body reacts as if it's ill, and it can be very damaging to your health. You know, by the same token, it can also, you know, if fear can kind of clear your circuits, as it were. And to finally arrive at the point of a story I started to tell a long time ago, the pilot who survived this low altitude, his wings started to fall off. Through this incredible series of events that I strongly encourage your listeners to rush out and buy the book and read this fascinating story. But the punchline of it is that he finds himself safe and sound on the ground, and he's sitting on the grass, and he writes that the grass has never been greener, the sky has never been bluer, he's never been more vividly alive than he is in that moment. And there's this intensity of experience that we feel when we're in a dangerous or a threatening situation. And I think anyone who's ever been in that situation, if they can recall, you know, standing up in front of that meeting or giving that report and feeling the clammy terror, and then afterwards it's done, and there's such a wave of relief.
There's a rush after that, and you just feel
great
about it.
It feels like you've been purged, like any stress. And, you know, when we so often in life, you know, the taxes are building up, and we haven't paid our medical bill, and, you know, our boss is getting on our case, and you just feel this slow accumulation of, like, gunge in your nerves. You know, you just feel like you're getting just clogged. And then this thing happened. It's like the pipes have been blown clear, and it's a wonderful thing. And so it can become addictive. And, you know, as you started performing for your relatives, and now you're, you know, performing for millions of people.
Here
every
I am.
Night. And it's a wonderful thing. What a doorway that it opened for you.
Indeed. Jeff, when we come back, I want you to give us that one big piece of advice for people who have to deal with fears in their life. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines and give you an opportunity to chat with Jeff Wise, author of Extreme Fear. Those of you who have a question or you want to share your fearful story with us, especially those of you who have witnessed things, gone through it, police officers, some of you truck drivers out there who have gone through some pretty fearful things, I'm sure. Why don't you share that with us in a moment at coasttocoastam.com. Jeff, can you get your book at amazon.com as well?
Yeah, that's right. You can go to Amazon and look for Extreme Fear. There's also a link on my website, jeffwise.net.
And are you on Facebook, Twitter? You do that yet?
Facebook, yep. If you look for Jeff Wise and Twitter at Extreme Fear. If people want to send questions, I love to dialogue with people. I've heard some fascinating stories from people that way.
Okay, we'll stick around. We're going to come back. Final hour to go here on Coast to Coast AM. You can always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back.